That was the most interesting introduction I have ever had. I was really beginning to sweat there, thinking, wow, I've been busy with things I didn't realize. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here again. I don't know about you, but homeschooling conventions have always been a real boost for me personally, coming away energized, inspired, and encouraged, and I really hope that that's your experience. I also hope that as the school year is almost to an end, that you have had some really good learning things happening this year in your own family, if you've already started. But this morning I'm going to share on learning through nature and what it is and why it's so important to fit it into our very busy schedules, because most of us are running faster than we can keep up with. And this is a subject very close to my heart. I love being out in nature. I grew up that way. And so I'm also glad to be sharing on something that's all positive this year, or pretty well all positive. So I want to start with a definition so that we all understand exactly what I'm talking about. It sounds very basic, but what it is, learning through nature happens when someone interacts, either through observation or manipulation, with something that God has created. Okay? So someone interacting with something that God has made. So that sounds very simple, but there are certain parameters that it has to stay within. For example, it has to be a direct experience of the person. It's not a spectator thing. It's not watching a nature show. It's not reading a National Geographic magazine. It's not looking at picture books. And all of those resources are very good, but that's not the way we learn through nature. That's a one-dimensional learning. And learning through nature is three, four, five-dimensional learning. So also internet video cams, which is something that's come up in the last few years. Fascinating. But that's also not what I'm specifically referring to. It needs to be something where you're observing, something yourself, where you can hear, smell, hopefully feel, manipulate. And it needs to be self-directed as much as possible. So it's not you taking your children for a walk and doing a monologue on all the interesting things that you see, because actually then you are interfering with them focusing on what is meaningful to them. So it's a very personal experience. Outdoor sports also don't fall into this category, because once again, you're focused on an activity other than what God has created. Museums, as great as they are, also don't count, obviously, because you're looking at things through glass. It has to be something that allows as many senses as possible to be engaged. Okay, so those are the parameters in which I'm talking. It doesn't always have to be outdoors. It can also be inside, but it needs to be someone interacting, observing, manipulating with something that God has made. So it sounds very basic, but in our society, which is the most plugged in history, it seems to happen very little and happen less and less. And this limited contact for our children really robs them of incredible delight and incredible learning opportunities. And so that's what we're going to sort of talk about today. Now, does everybody feel like they understand what I mean when I say learning through nature? Did I explain that well enough? Okay, because stop me if it wasn't clear. Okay, so come on in. So why bother adding something else to already very pressured schedules? Well, the main reason is that God has left his fingerprints over all of his creation. And for most parents, the spiritual well-being of their children is very important. And this is one natural way, make a pun, of allowing them to observe and become familiar with some of God's attributes through nature. As you spend time in nature or with animals or that sort of thing, you gain a knowledge you become aware of design and that sort of thing. And as your understanding grows, it can draw you closer to God. It can make you just feel the awe of this incredible designer. God has left a testament of himself. The psalmist says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech." So there are attributes about God that we can learn best if we spend some time out in nature. The study of celestial can give us an understanding of how awesome God is. Now, we're not going to go into a spaceship and go to the moon. So we're going to have to do some of that with the Googling and that sort of thing as far as exploring how vast space is. But as we compare the vastness of creation with our finiteness, it should lead us to feel awed by the fact that he loves us. Because we're so small compared to how great and how powerful he is. And so that's an understanding or a learning that's very important. Psalm 8 says, "When I consider the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have made, what is man that you're mindful of him? What is man that you care for him?" So once again, we look at the complex integrated designs that God has in nature and the fact that he actually is interested in us and cares for us personally. And so these are things that children begin to absorb without maybe being able to put a lot of labels to it, but they're things that they're learning and beginning to understand. Now, of course, God didn't just leave his fingerprints all over astronomy, but in Genesis it says that God saw all he made and it was good. And so he's got his fingerprints in all of creation, whether it's a rock, whether it's a plant, whether it's a bee, whatever, anything that he has made. So from a spiritual perspective, it's really worth our attention and time, making space for it. So there are so many benefits to this, and a lot of science experiments have been done in the last 20 years to really pinpoint what the benefits are. There's been a lot of folklore information about it, but some scientists and psychologists have really tried to narrow down, really, are the benefits there, or is it just what people say? But aside from the spiritual benefit, there's also physical, emotional, mental, academic benefits to spending time with nature. I'm going to just read some of those in point form because I have a lot to cover. But on the physical aspect, usually if you're outside, there's more physical activity, and that's very important to our overall health. It improves coordination, agility, stamina, develops keener senses. One experiment found that just watching natural landscapes, being able to look out at a tree or a pond, actually eases muscles tension and lowers one's pulse. So for some of us, I think when we're homeschooling, we need to put a plant on the table. Another study discovered that just watching fish in an aquarium lowers blood pressure. So there's just something to it. They even found that those people who have pets are much better at surviving heart attacks. So if there are heart problems in your family, I would suggest getting a pet, because somehow it helps us to calm down. Mentally, it actually reduces the symptoms of ADHD, which is fabulous. Stress reduction, which most of us struggle with, stimulates the imagination and encourages curiosity. Emotionally, it has a calming effect. It helps children work through issues, and it builds confidence. And academically, it inspires creativity, provides opportunity for innovation, improves attention, which is interesting, strengthens cognitive abilities, actually improves academic scores. And I think one of the reasons why it does that is that when you're out there interacting with nature, it lavishly invites you towards ingenuity and creativity. It's not you're not forced into conformity. And what I mean by that, my daughter had a wand from Disney, you know, one of those princess wands, okay, plastic, lights flashing, said stuff. The only thing that she could use that for was a wand. Okay, she would feel very foolish trying to use that as a walking stick or anything else. But if you have a stick, that can become anything that your imagination will, that you need, anything. A lance, a spear, you know, all sorts of things, a rod, a fishing rod. And as you can tell, I have had boys, so a lot of weapons in there. But I started off saying no weapons, but after all the sticks and the Legos, I gave up.
Fingers.
So when you're out in nature, what's there, the resources, all you need is imagination, and the child can create a world for themselves, role model things with a lot of freedom. And the other thing is, if we want our children to have any sort of a sense of stewardship for the planet, they have to have some connection to it. If they don't know it, if they haven't had personal experience with it, they won't value it. And then don't expect them to recycle or all the rest, because it will really seem irrelevant to them. So that's another part of it. About 20 years ago, somebody in Germany thought that they would run with this idea and see what would happen. And so they initiated something called Waldkindergarten, which is just forest kindergartens. And it's spread now throughout all of Europe. There are some in the United States. I don't know if we have any in Canada. But with this concept, it's very simple. The children go to a center and they spend all day outside with their peers and a teacher and a supervisor. And it's mostly under non-directed play. And at first you think, well, what could they be learning? And, you know, where's the paper trail and all that sort of thing? But they have had some fascinating results, and I have to read you this quote because it really summarizes the benefits at already a very early age, and then these benefits continue later on. So this is what they found. Playing outside for prolonged periods has been shown to have a positive impact on children's development, particularly in the areas of balance and agility, but also manual dexterity, physical coordination, tactile sensitivity, and depth perception. According to these studies, children who attend forest kindergartens experience fewer injuries due to accidents and less likely to injure themselves in a fall. A child's ability to assess risks improves. Playing outdoors strengthens the immune system. When children from German Waldkindergartens got to primary school, having done no book work, the teachers observed a significant improvement in knowledge and skills in specific subjects. Reading, despite not having used books formally. Mathematics, constructive contributions to learning, asking questions and interest in learning. Motivation, sports, music, art, creativity, positive social behavior, religion, concentration, and handling writing and painting equipment. Wow! Don't you just want to rush out there and take your kids with you? So they have had an enormous positive response to this sort of experiment that they did, and it's just taking off. So I hope you're all convinced that it's worth thinking about or taking a look into. I thought you might find it a little interesting to know that this has been understood by educators throughout the millennium. We're just rediscovering it now. Somehow with technology, you know, the Industrial Revolution, technology and being digitally connected, we've lost that knowledge. Now, I come from a city, so maybe your children spend a lot of time outside, but hopefully through this session, if they do, you'll go home feeling less guilty about all the time they play outside, because it's actually a very good thing. So, history, this knowledge that interacting with nature is the best way to learn has been there for a long time. Now, the people that I'm going to read quotes from, I'm not endorsing them. Some of them had some other wacky ideas, so I'm just referring to their educational practices, okay? So please don't say that, you know, I was an advocate of Rousseau or something. So just their educational philosophy. Found it fascinating. And we start with Plato, hundreds of years before Christ, you know? And he said something very interesting about what learning sticks. And it's not, he doesn't specifically talk about being outside, but he talks about play. And a lot of learning that happens outside happens through play. And he says, I just love it, for the free man, there should be no element of slavery in learning. Enforced exercise does no harm to the body, but enforced learning will not stay in the mind. So avoid compulsion and let your children's lessons take the form of play. I could chew on that for a long time, but I'll move on to Comenius, the late Renaissance, and this is just a little anecdote of what he did with some of his students. They are delighted, talking about the students, to construct little houses and to erect walls of clay, chips, wood, or stone, and thus displaying an architectural genius. And so he allowed the children to build themselves shelters and that sort of thing. Rousseau said, let the student not be taught science. Let him discover it. Why not begin by showing him the real thing, that he may at least know what you're talking about? I love it. Pestalozzi, whatever you can teach him from the nature of things themselves, do not teach him by words. Leave him to himself to see, hear, and find. And this wisdom, for me anyway, even though I grew up having this carefree childhood outside, is hard to run with because we're so pressured, if you're an Adele, with learning outcomes, paper trail, test results, that allowing the child the freedom to actually explore and observe and absorb things that maybe they can't always articulate is hard. You have to trust the process. Pestalozzi also has this anecdote of what he did with his students. The students began by turning their steps to an out-of-the-way valley. This valley we had to look at as a whole and in its different parts until we had a correct and complete impression of it. Then we were told, each one, to dig out a certain quantity of the clay, which was embedded in layers on one side of the valley. And with this, we filled large sheets of paper brought with us for the purpose. When we got back to school, each child had to build, with clay, a model of the valley where we had just made our observations. Then, and only then, did we turn our attention to the map, which we had now gained the power of correctly interpreting. So this idea of allowing children to explore and learn things outside before you give them the words and the paper and the having to record it. Many of you are probably familiar with Charlotte Mason. She also incorporated this in her teaching. She was in the Victorian age. So she just did the academic work in the morning, and then the afternoon was all free for play. Yes?
And who said that about getting the clay and then...
That was Pestalozzi, 1746 to 1827. So a long time ago, they already understood the power of allowing a child to learn. Yes, Charlotte Mason encouraged nature walks, and parents could answer questions and point things of interest, but they were not to lecture. And for some of us who like to teach, there's a tendency to just, you know, talk and not allow the child to actually really focus or get into what they have an interest in. In 1890, William James, the father of American psychology, published his findings. I love this too, that too much directed attention, bookwork, lecture, tests, comprehension questions, okay, that sort of stuff, caused fatigue, which led to, now does this not describe some of our schools, impulsive behavior, agitation, irritation, and an inability to concentrate. So, if your children are having these problems, maybe you should throw them outside for a bit, and give them a break. On the other hand, fascination or involuntary attention, which is what happens outside, or could happen outside, as would be the case in observing nature, was restorative. Not only is it restorative, but they're actually having the opportunity to really learn something. Last example, John Dewey gave another example of what he did with his students. A gully near the school building not only furnished a splendid place for play, but serves as a textbook in mountain ranges, valleys and soil, and rock formation. So those are the educators of the past that have incorporated that in their learning from the youngest age all the way to the older ones. In the 70s, organizations sprung up to champion this sort of learning, to get it into the schools. In England, it was learning through landscapes. In the United States, it was Project Learning Tree. And in Canada, it was Learning Grounds. And I've made a note of those on your resource, the second page, in case you want to look them up for ideas or things that they're still doing. More studies have been done by scientists. They have found that just looking at nature for employees allows them to be more enthusiastic, involved. Terry Hartick in 2001, a psychologist, he put together a 40-minute sequencing exercise that was designed to fatigue the person. And then after the participants had done the exercise, they were split into three groups. One group went for a walk in nature, one group went for a walk in the city, and one group just sat quietly on a couch listening to music and reading a magazine. And it was the group that had the chance to walk in nature that performed much better on a proofreading exercise afterwards and were much more relaxed and just happy in general. They recovered from their fatiguing exercise. So study after study shows that there are all these benefits that are sometimes hard to pinpoint, but they're there. In the United States in 2002, the State Education and Environmental Roundtable, sounds very impressive, decided to introduce a new program for some of their most troubled schools. And they called it the Interactive Environment Curriculum, which is just what we've been talking about. But they have had amazing results. Over a two-year period, the number of disciplinary referrals, like you've been bad, go to the principal sort of thing, went from 560 a year to 50. So somehow allowing the children to get out to learn in a less book and sitting environment made a huge difference. Last example is from Finland. In 2003, they outscored 31 other countries in literacy. They're the top country. And they came the top five for math and science. And they credit it to these things. They don't start school until 7. They have a national standard curriculum, but they give the teachers a really wide leeway about how they're going to actually teach that to children. They believe in play, so every 45 minutes of class is broken up with a 15-minute recess. And a substantial amount of the learning is taken outside of the classroom into nature or into the community. So they have also incorporated this concept in their public schools and have seen huge results academically. Their students do very well. So I think that's enough for all the reasons why it's worth taking a look at. There's a lot of support for this, even though our culture perhaps doesn't value it or give it much space. So what does it look like? It's actually very simple. And that's why sometimes I think it's hard for us to incorporate, because if we're going to have this many benefits, we expect it to be complex, you know? But what it looks like is you taking your child or children outside and giving them some time to explore, to interact. You don't go with a lesson plan. You don't go with a monologue. You don't go with worksheets. You just take them outside to a lake, a river, a meadow, a forest, an orchard, something that is as wild as possible. Our parks, you know, with the swings are already too structured. So it's just some wild space and give them undirected time. Now, if your children don't have much opportunity for them, for that sort of thing, you'll have to give them extra time to switch gears. They're really used to a very structured life. All of a sudden, this free space, they're going to be a bit disoriented and not quite know what to do with it. But it will come with time. So they're out there and they can either observe animal behavior, like if one child is interested in insects, if they want to plunk themselves in front of a rhodo bush and watch the bees for half an hour, they will learn so much more and they will retain it and it will become part of them in a way that no book is ever going to do for them. If they're the kind that wants to build things, need to climb something, you know, that sort of thing, let them do that. There's nothing like allowing a child to dam up a little rivulet, and I say little, like let's not be damming up streams, because then I'll get into trouble, for them to absorb intuitively bank erosion or the fact that water follows the path of least resistance, or how different materials respond to the friction of water. You could read that to them in a book, but it will sort of be irrelevant unless they've really tried to dam something up and this thing is, you know, the water's gone every which way. When a child has the opportunity to observe a swallow catching insects in mid-flight, or a hummingbird drinking nectar, or a falcon catching its prey, they absorb the connection between design and function. And this connection is going to translate into so many different areas of learning, right? That if something is designed for a certain way, then it has a certain function. And that will play out in so many other areas. A child needs to experience an empty place for them to experience a need for shelter, okay? And that's a good thing. Because once they experience that need for shelter, most kids will want to build one, and then you have the planning. Usually there's cooperation with other people. There's the engineering process of, okay, support and that sort of thing. And as long as they're not going to hurt themselves seriously, you know, a little bit of scrape and that sort of thing I think is also very helpful, then allow them to build that structure even though you could build it better, even though you could build it faster. Okay, give them the joy of building it themselves and failing, and then going, okay, well, that doesn't work, so let me try something else. And they will absorb architectural sort of principles without having any words for them. But later on, when they read them in a textbook, when they study that, it will gel for them, and it will be theirs in a way that somebody who hasn't had that experience isn't going to have the same depth. It's not going to have the same meaning for them. Now, if your children are really new to being outside, and I don't know, I'm assuming that being in Kelowna, your kids spend a lot of time outside, because I come from Surrey, so, you know, my kids spend very little time outside now that they're older. How many of you actually have children that spend a lot of time outside? Yeah? Okay. That's good. That gives me hope for the next generation. But if for whatever reason, family background or circumstances, you haven't been out much, and or some place that is just a wild area, and your child is just sitting there and saying, this is so boring and I have nothing to do, these are two books that I used with my children, Sharing with Nature and Journey to the Heart of Nature. This is for younger children, this is for older children, and they're just simple games or exercises that you initially do with your children so that they sort of get, you know, what they're actually supposed to be doing out there or how they can sort of interact with things. He has a bit of a new age slant, but I would just... This is for the younger children, and this is for the, like, teenagers. He has a bit of a new age slant, but I just, you know, ignore it because he's on to a lot of really good ideas. So, for example, you blindfold a child, you take them to a tree, and they can explore that tree through all their senses except sight. Smell, the feel, that sort of thing. Then you remove them, and you take, like, a ways away, and you take off the blindfold, and now they have to find their tree. So it's games like that, simple exercises that really allows the child to sort of catch on, you know, what he's allowed to do and that sort of thing. As the children get older, you know, they can't, sometimes the learning has to be more focused, right? And so you can still give them a lot of freedom, but there are many specific areas that they can choose from. And it should be interest-based or maybe availability-based. There are so many different areas that you could look at. Like there's fishing, there's gardening, there's hiking, there's camping, there's stargazing, there's rock collecting. And hopefully you're not like me who, you know, would love their children to know a little bit about absolutely everything. The reality in life is that our children are going to be able to learn so much less than we really would like them to. And so if they spend, you know, most of their childhood years or teenage years learning everything about birding, it's okay. Those skills will translate into any other area that they are going to need to work through or become competent in. They don't have to know how to fish and hike and stargaze and all the rest. If they really have one particular interest, leave them there. You know, there's so much that you can learn in just one area. There's also something called wildcrafting, which is knowing the names of plants for medicinal purposes and crafts and that sort of thing. So it all depends on your child's personality, right? If your child hates hiking, you can drag them out a few times and see if they can learn a love. And if your whole family hikes, well, then they're just going to come along. But do leave a space for them to interact with nature in something that they really love, that they really find an interest in, because it'll make your life a lot easier too. So allow them to explore with minimal interference. The only thing that I would suggest is, let's say with birding or rock collecting or whatever it is, to have a little nature journal, which is just theirs, where they can put their observations in. This is not for essays. This is not to replicate the encyclopedia. This is for them to put down what they've observed. And so if you have a child that likes to write, well, let them write it. If you have a child that just loves words, let them just plunk down words. If the child loves color, take pencil crayons with you and let them just, on that page, put in the colors that they saw that grabbed their imagination. If they're a collector, take something so that they can glue their stuff on that page. There are so many ways for them to record what they've observed. Give them some freedom. This is their journal. And in years later, when they look at it, it will bring back so many sweet memories of things learned, because it's a reflection of their experience, right? Not a curriculum-directed outcome. And there has to be a place for that, too. If your child is really into gardening, there's a really neat way of doing it. It's called square foot gardening, where you do it in plots like this, and it's extremely manageable. Nobody's going to get overwhelmed. And so there's a mention of that on your second resource page, too, in case you're interested in that. If for some reason you're housebound because of illness or season in life, and sometimes, especially if we have babies, we can't get out quite as much, there's so much you can do for them still to have this type of experience in the home. So houseplants, right? Go to the nursery, let them pick out a houseplant. They water it, they fertilize it, they prune it, they dust it, they pollinate it, whatever. If you have boys, I would suggest a Venus flytrap. Most boys really love that, even though I find it a little disgusting. But it's for them, right? If that's too much, if they're really, really young, take one of those baby food jars, you know, those glass ones, and put a dried bean seed right close to the edge so that they can see that bean swell, put down the tap root, and put up these green shoots. I mean, just being able to observe that and having to make it a little bit wet, the soil, over time, just sort of enables them to incorporate this metamorphosis, this transformation that is possible. And that knowledge will translate into other areas of learning. And it's fabulous when they have those opportunities. If your kids hate plants, that's not a problem. If any of you, I'm sure you've all looked at homeschool resource catalogs. They've got worm farms, ant hills, butterfly hatcheries, stick insect things. You name it. There's something there that you can come, take into your home, contain, hopefully, and and learn about. And there's, I don't know, with my children, I found that there was something that they could care for and see change, that they were really interested, they were curious, and I wasn't having to drag them to the school table. So those are some ideas there. Charlotte Mason says, teach the thing before the name. And because then it really sticks, then it has a relevance, then they have some experience with it. If you want your kids to have more experience than you're able to give them outside, then there are things like 4-H clubs, conservation groups that run programs, hiking clubs that they would be included in, outdoor rec programs, when they're older, outdoor bound. Some summer camps also have really nature programs. There's lots of things out there. One of the neatest sites that I found was the Puget Sound Environmental Learning Center, and I think I have that on your resource page too. It's just outside of Seattle. They do day camps, and if somebody had a lot of money and decided to pour it into this thing, and it's a combination between Tom Sawyer's Magical World and the technology of a space station and the serenity of a wilderness. So I'd love to go there sometime. I think it's on the SEC. Is it there? There's a website. Yes. So I wish it was closer. It would be fun to do that. So as I was reading about all these benefits that I sort of had known about too intuitively, but now I had all the scientific information about it, I thought, well, I'm just going to try this out on my kids. So I said to them, I'm doing a seminar, and I'd like to do an experiment. And anybody who participates, I'll buy them a Tim Hortons lunch. And they were all into that. You know, there's nothing like food for bribery. So they came, and all they had to do is fill in a really short survey, how I'm feeling, sort of thing. And then they had to spend 30 minutes in a cedar tree. And on the coast, our cedar trees are very dense, so that you can't see in and you can't see out. So they had to sit in the cedar tree by themselves, or stand, for 30 minutes without any electronic gadgets, and they could just smell, touch, look, feel, okay? At first they looked at me as if I had lost my mind, but that Tim Hortons lunch kept them going. So they all three of them did it, and then after they were finished, they filled out a bit more of the survey saying, you know, how did they feel now, and their experiment, okay? Let's test this, I thought. So the youngest one had the textbook response, came back enthusiastic, happy, energized. Okay, so I'm like, all right, check. That's good. The other child, my middle child, who is in that awkward sort of middle teenage years, I think was so worried the whole time that people would wonder what he was doing in the tree. That he couldn't really relax, so for him it was a neutral, right? it was just like that. Might be his age. The most interesting for me was the response that my most digitally connected child had. And they came back and filled with nostalgia. And it had the smell of the cedar tree had brought back memories of all these outdoor activities and things they had done. And what it did is it drew them back to hobby that is very creative and very tactile that they hadn't done for years. And I was absolutely delighted because that meant less screen time. And so he's been doing that for quite some time. So very interesting. Different responses a little bit from different personalities, but it was certainly worth doing it. So when you first go out and take your kids there, remember that there's no right way of doing it, really, unless you're, just don't talk the whole time, right? Give them their space, but there's no perfect way of doing it. If you're relaxed and enthusiastic, that will sort of integrate to them. So if you're first starting off, just start with short and easy, right? Don't say, okay, today we're going to hike for 4 hours, and, you know, you won't bring them back, or they'll never, ever go out with you again. Now, I did want to address quickly why a lot of us don't. Why don't we make the time? What is it that interferes with us integrating something that's so simple and has so many benefits? Why don't we, you know? And I think it's both our society and our parenting. When I think of my childhood, I grew up in Kelowna, came here at 5, left at 18. As long as I told my mother basically where I was going, I had the run of a huge backyard with fruit trees. Then we had the neighborhood pond and huge willow tree. Then there was an orchard and a river and the open spaces to school. I had miles in which to explore, and I did. I was really sad as I was preparing this seminar when I realized, in contrast, that my daughter has her backyard, and that's it. I live in Surrey. I have drug houses around me. I will not risk an abduction. I cannot give her that freedom. And it made me really sad that I can't where I am. In lieu of that, I take her out a lot. We go to a park, so we hike, and that sort of thing. So You know, my house sometimes doesn't look very good because I'm needing to take her out and I don't have as much in the home, but for me it's worth it. She has certainly lost something in not having the freedom to explore, but we need to adjust a little bit to our society and also to where we live. In Kelowna, perhaps you can give your children more freedom. At this point, as a 12-year-old in inner city Surrey, I can't give that. One of the main reasons that we don't just let our children have the run of nature is fear. And sometimes it's valid, and sometimes it's paranoia. The second reason is unpredictability. If you're a little bit like me, who likes to really be in control, when you go out into nature, things happen. You know, things don't always just line up the way you'd like it to. I remember one winter, I took my children to the Serpentine River. It was January, the dikes were still frozen. Beautiful in sort of a stark way. And we stopped to let the boys kneel at the side of one of the dikes and skip ice chunks across, watching it skid, you know. I was sure they were learning something about physics in that. And lo and behold, one of them lost their balance and plunged headfirst into the dike through the ice. Thankfully, the ice wasn't too thick. They came back up. But that was the end of that excursion, because in January he was completely drenched from head to foot. That really got my adrenaline going, but no harm done. Another time in January, we were at Crescent Beach, and my boys were damming up a little stream and having a wonderful time. I had them in the appropriate gear, you know, but do boys pay attention to where their rubber boots end? No. So, you know, it's the water fills in, it goes up the leg and up the leg, and by the time they were wet to the waist, I thought, before somebody calls social services, I better take them home, right? Get them warm and dry. So when you take your kids out and you allow them to climb trees or get dirty and wet, that sort of thing, expect some looks from adults, other adults. You're going to get smiles from those people that remember carefree childhoods, and you're going to get big frowns from those people that never had it. So you're just going to have to shrug it off and know it's part of it. The third reason is that a lot of our green spaces are now urban parks. And several years ago, all I wanted was a few little frog eggs. Okay, I wanted my children to see the transformation from egg to frog. And I found out that if I remove one frog egg from a local park, it'll cost me $300. You can't take anything out of a park. I was not very happy about that, but I decided not to risk it. Now, here in Kelowna, I hope you have less regulations, but for those in the city, urban regulations is one factor, too. The other factor is most of our children aren't growing up on farms, and so they don't have as many chores as people did one or two generations ago, so they have more free time. But in our society, we can't leave them just to run around all the time, and so we fill their time with structured activities. Lots of sports, music, homework, help, you know, all things that are good, but their free time is gone. It's all structured. And so somehow we have to find a balance between structured activities and just completely unstructured space for them. The last reason why we don't maybe gravitate to this sort of learning is that the natural sciences have really become less popular in the schools or even in the universities. Botany, astronomy, zoology, biology, not very popular. Why? Because microbiology is the new wonder, because you can make money from it. And it's harder to turn botany and all those other things into money, into profit. And so even when your children go to university later on, there isn't going to be in many places a rock solid sort of natural science curriculum or courses available for them. So you have to sort of look at why for yourself, whether it's schedule or fears or that sort of thing, why your children don't have that time to really interact with nature as much as they should or could. Because I think if we assess our fears and we look at our schedule, we can make space for this sort of learning. I think interacting with nature really creates a more balanced, healthy child. They're able to cope better with some of the stresses because they've just had a little time away from direct supervision and all these demands, productivity sort of thing. So it just takes some thought and flexibility. And not only, I think, is it better for them, you know, spiritually and physically, but also academically. It's been proven over and over again that those kids that have enough time to play outside, to learn outside, that it makes a difference. So when your child just is sitting there staring at a bumblebee, you know, and you're getting impatient, or when they're taking a flower and they're actually ripping it apart petal by petal, don't do it in a park, petal by petal, you know, looking at the little stalks and seeing how it's all made, or whether they stop in completely mesmerized wonder at how this worm is trying to get out of the mud puddle, you know, how it's moving and that sort of thing. Just realize that they are learning things not only about nature, but about so many other principles that they're going to encounter later on. And it's well worth the effort. Unhook yourself a little bit from the paper trail and the learning outcomes and all that sort of thing. And I think you will have happier children, and you will maybe be very surprised at some of the observations that they come up with. So I had to talk a bit fast this morning because I want to leave a little bit of time for questions in case there was something that I missed, or if you had an anecdote or a question that you wanted to ask. So, yes?
You said something about a program that didn't start school until they were seven.
Yes.
That was interesting. Could you elaborate?
That's in Finland. That's their national policy. And there is a push that's been on for quite some time called Early Start. It has many different names. You know, earlier and earlier preschool activities, you know, early and early kindergarten, because they think if you start earlier, they're going to have an academic advantage, when really all the research shows that by the time they're in grade one or two, they have no academic advantage at all. What it does for governments is it allows children to be supervised so the mothers can work. So in Finland, they've taken the opposite approach. They're really relaxed and say, we'll start school at seven. And I think that the child has reached a maturity at seven, you know, mentally, physically, that they're more able to actually learn. So then they learn it faster. And it's not so stressful for them, right? So I'm really supportive of that.
I think it's also by law that one parent has to stay home with the child until they're seven, too.
In Finland?
Yeah.
That's also brilliant.
So that they have, like, a lot of, like, they have, if they are working, then they have, like, really great daycares within their environment.
That's close to home or in the workplace, right? So the mom can have some contact. Yeah. When I hear of them trying to push more and more daycare across Canada, it's like it's the wrong way, you know? It's going to cause so much more, another stress generation, right? Especially since if it was like Waldkindergarten, then that's something different, right? But the indoor, they have done studies that show that children find it quite stressed to be in a room where there's a lot of other people for hours and hours, and because of the noise, the constant noise, the way it bounces and reverberates, it's different outside, you know. Yes?
This is my first year homeschooling. I have four kids, mm-hmm. age 11, and the whole idea of nature study, if you want to call it that, I love it. And we have an acre and we have lots of trees and stuff, but I still find that my kids, I've so kind of lost that ability, that the natural instinct of a child to want to go out and want to touch and explore. And I'll tell them to go outside. Stop, you know, it's a mess when mm-hmm. go outside. I don't know if they have to. And then they're outside and it's okay. But what they do is like is play soccer and mm-hmm. jump in the trampoline. But they won't necessarily go and observe the trees mm-hmm. or, you know, find a butterfly. They don't have that mindset.
Yes.
And so
yeah.
My question is how, without the whole thing, now we're going to actually go look for a butterfly and direct them in doing mm-hmm. that. How can I otherwise develop that instinctive desire to connect with nature in them?
Okay.
They've kind of lost that ability.
Yeah, I think most children, I think, have lost the ability to a great extent. But there's two ways you can do it. One, at the beginning, you can model it. So that means you say, okay, we're all going to go outside, and we're going to sit, and you pick a patch, wherever it is, and they all sit. And you give them a certain amount of time in which to just look and smell and that sort of thing. whatever, like, okay, by 11, maybe they have the attention span for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, okay? And then after that, they have to tell you what they heard and saw. And they have to see if they can come up with something new. It just makes them quiet, and they will be surprised at what somebody else saw that they didn't see. Now, that's just one little exercise that you can do with them, right? Games like are in here will also help. Something I did with my niece, I like to experiment on the children around me, right? So she is a very precocious three-year-old, so I thought, and this is something that would you could work. I said to her, I found a surprise outside. You know, and they're like, oh, surprise. You know, what's the surprise? That it's a marvelous surprise. And I took her outside and I showed her this plant and I said, can you see the surprise? She's looking at it. And I said, look, I said, the stem is red. If I was drawing a bush or a tree, I would draw it green or brown, but it's red. And this all of a sudden fascinated her because it focused her on something that she wouldn't expect. Like, who'd expect a red stem, right? And so you could send your children outside and say, you have got whatever time to find a surprise, something that you didn't see before or didn't know. And then it becomes sort of like a hunting game and to try that way to sort of get them into it. It is challenging, though, because they're just so used to... Yes, oh, the computer.
One thing that works for our kids is sometimes is when they're bored and have nowhere to be. Like, for example, is we're going to go hiking with somebody, or we're going to do something with somebody. We'll meet them at such a like a place. But if I go there early, then we'll be there by the creek and have nothing to do, right? So they're sitting there by the creek, they have nothing to do. Well, then kids are great. It's figuring out play. We didn't bring the soccer ball, you know, or whatever, right? So they're there, and it's not like you're saying you have to go spend 20 minutes by the creek. You know, you're just waiting for somebody, and so they don't clue in, and they're bored, and when they're bored, they find things to do, and they start, you know.
This is very true. I have intentionally left space for my kids to be bored. Like, I have facilitated chunks of boredom. And they come to me and they're just whining away. And I said, yeah, we're just going to let you be bored until you can think of something interesting to do and leave it as a vacuum. They won't stay there long, right? And if they're outside, they'll come up with something in the desperation because there's a need. Who wants to sit there being bored, right? So allowing, creating space where they just have to come up with something. Yes?
Okay.
Do you know why she's especially fussy and irritable?
If I knew, that would make my life a lot easier. She's been like that since she was born. She can go out, and I go out many times. I stay at home, and I go out with her in the forest, and she can have a great time. But if it's just not her day, or if the sun's not shining right, or I don't know what it is, it can make, instead of an hour-long adventure into a 10-minute, okay, that's it, we're going back in the car and scratch this day off. Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
it certainly can. One person or one difficult personality can completely boycott the whole thing. And you're not always going to be able to, you know, send them out, stay home, or have somebody else with your daughter. I would just continue to encourage you to really try to find out why she's like that, whether it's a physiological thing, physical thing, because if she's been that way from birth, then she might have special challenges that as soon as you understand them, you're going to be able to respond to her in a way that will really help. And because if she's really fussy, there's something bothering her. There's something that's tipped out of balance. And having a child like that, I know how important it is to try to understand the child. until that sort of understanding comes together, having maybe a favorite blanket or a favorite snack, or that sort of thing is probably the best you can do, right? At times, maybe leaving her at home with somebody else, if that's ever possible, just so that your other kids don't feel that this trip is going to be interrupted. That they at least sometimes have times where, you know, they can just really go for it. But I really sympathize, because it is difficult when you do have one in the group that somehow something just sets them sideways, and then they truly cannot cope, and they fall apart, and then nobody is coping. So, sure. Yeah, no, that's a good suggestion. There are so many things that you have to explore when you're on that journey of trying to understand why this child just doesn't respond within the average parameters. And they're, don't assume it's just bad temper. There's something bothering them. Any other questions? Yes?
Being in Surrey, do you or did you take your kids out in the rain?
Oh, yes. Because if I didn't, they wouldn't get out much. Because I grew up exploring the outdoors, I did that with my children. I couldn't set them free, but I did it with them. And I tried not to always be right beside them. As long as I could see them, they had the freedom. So they spent their childhoods going to the beach and the forest and the river, and I just took them out every chance I got and let them run off steam and explore and manipulate. And you do run into some issues, you know, with people being upset because something's been dammed up and they think the whole neighborhood's going to flood or whatever. But, you know, you have to just work through those things. And I think it really made a difference in their childhood. And we had to go out rain or shine. So they had rain jackets. And as long as they don't get chilled, being wet isn't going to make them sick, right? Because honestly, in the Lower Mainland, you can't wait for a sunny day. No, it's... You don't, oh, are you? Yeah. Yes.
But if my kids don't want to go out because it's raining, I just say, well, we'll see how the rain tastes today. And then it works really well. They run out and they taste it just to see if it's different.
That's very creative. See how the rain tastes. That's good. Yes. Yes.
I just want to really put an exclamation mark behind a lot of the things you said, especially the strange looks. We had our daughters out at the beach last summer, and they were cracking open oysters and exploring. The mm-hmm. And these 10-year-old boys came along, and they were horrified that we were hurting the oysters.
Yeah.
And so my daughters came back to the boys. You know, so we had to say it's okay.
When they interact with nature, it's not like you're going to always be able to leave everything pristine. I mean, I'm completely against mindless destruction. But if you're going to build something, often something needs to come down or moved, right? Cracking open the oysters, how else are you going to see inside? When you fish, you're actually killing something, but, you know, you are learning something at the same time. Patience and you know, what fish like to eat and all sorts of things. So... it's part of it. And, I mean, you have to use some precautions. I remember one year I allowed my children to be, like, the ocean opening up all these shellfish and that sort of thing. And I must not have thoroughly cleaned their hands with, you know, all that lovely stuff that you can now get to kill everything because they came down with parasites. that wasn't very much fun. But, you know, there's nothing like going through that experience to learn to wash your hands well, right? So it's part of the learning experience. So you can't have everything always calm, right? Learning often happens when things are a bit rocky or don't work out the way you'd like them to.
Thank you for sharing that, because sometimes I think we think things are going to go perfectly, and knowing that you went through that, okay, good.
Yeah, no, there's, I mean, my children have never broken anything. I mean, that's not the end of the world either, but thankfully they haven't broken anything, and so it's just been a lot of fun. Any other questions?
I just have a comment. Mm-hmm. I have a learner who was lucky enough to have like a little toad sort of get caught in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the opportunity to, you know, learn with the toad and mm-hmm. learn how to feed it. And he would just sit there, like, I guess for hours,
mm-hmm.
and just like watch this little toad and what he did. And the mom, she made a comment. She's like, yeah, fortunately you'd make mating calls at like 2 a.m. But I thought it was just how you talk about mm-hmm. that, how great he had that experience, you know, with mm-hmm. the toad. Because, like, you can't read that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they let it go. But
right. You know, and there are so many fabulous books out there, wonderful pictures, wonderful text, but that's sort of one-dimensional learning because it's visual, right? When you're actually interacting with something, you've got the hearing, you've got the feeling, you've got the smelling, you have your own personal reaction or response or involvement in it, and that takes the learning to a much deeper level, and you absorb principles of physics and mechanics and engineering that even though they can't put a word to it, later on they'll recognize it and they'll really grasp things at a higher level much faster. So it's very worthwhile. Any other questions? Yes?
When we were talking over the other night, it reminded me, I just found in my garage some pads that we made to sit on to observe nature. And it was just basically a big use of the people didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Need to be creative, right?
Yeah.
I mean, some children don't care at all about being wet and dirty whatsoever. I mean, now, I couldn't always take my children out, so sometimes they had to play in our backyard, and we had a big backyard, and I have two boys first, and they have lots of energy. And so they said, came to me one day and said, Mom, we'd like to dig a hole. I said, sure, there's your dad's shovels, you go dig a hole. And I have never seen so much enjoyment over digging a hole. Right? And they dug, and they dug, and they dug, and I thought, okay, good exercise, you know, they're outside, and they dug, and they dug, until this hole, I mean, it was like a pit, the two of them, and when they stood in it, it was up to their waist, okay, so what were they, maybe 10 and 8 or 11 and 9, and then they thought, wouldn't it be fun to have our own swimming hole? So then they filled it with water. Now you can imagine this pit, completely brown water. They get on their bathing suits, and the two of them are splashing each other and singing and laughing like two drunk sailors. And I thought, you know, this is unbelievable. But it didn't hurt them, the dirty water. Their muscles were stronger from all that digging. They learned about walls caving in. They learned about, you know, how the water and the dirt mixed to make this muddy water. So many things that, you know, they couldn't come in and say, Mom, this is what I learned. But through that interaction, so many things were understood at a better level, right? My daughter in her pretty little bathing suit stood a few feet away and went, ee! You know, whenever she got splashed a bit. Very different response to that experience. I have it on video camera in case I ever need to blackmail them. So, or something. Yes?
I find what you're talking about also encourages interaction with each other.
Yes.
And I think that that's important. If they're playing inside, sometimes they get fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just in too much of a confined area.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if they would have done that kind of activity inside, digging that and working together as a team.
No, probably not. It's too much my space, your space, my toy, your toy. And they needed each other, right? Couldn't dig the pit by themselves. In one of the studies, it said that those the closest childhood friendships are forged in outdoor activities. Which is also interesting, this common experience and adventure. Well, you've been absolutely fabulous. I release you to your outdoor adventures and wish you a lot of safety and fun.